we're only the happier to have you with us, especially if you happen to be visiting. We're glad that you have decided to join us this evening, that you are spending your time in what I believe to be a good pursuit, spending your time well and wisely in worshiping God together with us. Thank you for coming and assisting in that. I invite you to turn, if you would, to John chapter 9. We're going to begin this evening, at least, in John chapter 9. I would imagine many of you are like me. I find myself reading the Scripture sometimes and coming across these minor characters, we might call them. I understand talking about characters. They are real people, but in the narrative that the Gospels record and all throughout the Bible, we see men and women like this. These folks that only show up for a short period of time, maybe just say a couple of things, maybe just do a couple of things, and then they're gone forever. They don't appear again throughout the rest of the book. But they leave you just wanting to know more. You want to know more about this person that you've just read about who maybe has done something remarkable or has been portrayed in such an interesting and an unusual way. You just find yourself asking, what's this guy's background? How did he come to be like this? How would he have been shaped into this kind of person? Or what happened to him afterward? Don't you think of some of these people that Jesus met along the way, for instance? And you just wonder, what was the rest of their life like? Were they there on the day of Pentecost when the church was established? Were they there in the crowd that watched Jesus die? I mean, would they have been some of the people who saw his last moments? And what did they do afterward? Did they maintain their faith? Did that serve as a lasting impression on them? Were they faithful unto the end? We meet so many folks that we just, quite frankly, wish we knew more about. And many of them, like this man that we read about in John chapter 9, I just really wish I could have met someone like this and just sit down and talk to him and see what he was like. In John chapter 9, we're introduced to a man who was blind from birth in verse 1 of John 9. Jesus passed by this man and saw him, and his disciples ask, we maybe don't need to read too much into their apparent lack of any kind of sympathy or anything there, but they just really kind of gesture to the man and say, who's responsible for this? This man's very difficult state. Is this his fault? Did he sin in some way, or was it his parents who sinned? Jesus responded by saying it was not this man nor his parents who sinned, but that in the works of God should be revealed in him. I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. And so saying that in verse 6, he spat on the ground, made clay with the saliva, and anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay, and then told him to go and wash in the pool of Siloam, a word that is translated sent. A very particularly interesting meaning there. He's sending this man to go and do that, by which he will be healed. Later on, there will be some discussion over whether Jesus was in fact sent, whether he came from God himself or not. But Jesus sends the man to the pool of Siloam. The man obediently goes and washes and came back seeing. And apparently some people notice as he returns, maybe there was just something a little bit different about him. They don't really seem to recognize him. They're a little unsure. In verse 8, his neighbors and those who had previously seen this blind man, perhaps every day, sitting there begging for his subsistence. Is this not he who sat and begged? Some people said, yeah, that's him. And a few other folks said, no, he just looks like him. You know, just kind of his doppelganger. We all meet that person eventually somewhere out in the world who looks exactly like us. Or they look like somebody that we know really well. So we've got some people here saying, no, that's not him. It's just a really close resemblance. And he says kind of, well, guys, I'm here. I mean, you're talking around me. I'm right here. It's me. I'm the same guy that you've been seeing so often sitting here in this place begging. It's me. So they said, how did this happen? How were your eyes opened? And he answers very plainly and says, a man called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, go to the pool of Siloam and wash. So I went and washed and I received sight. And they said to him, where is he? And he said, I do not know. I don't know where he went after that. In verse 13, they brought this man who was formerly blind to the Pharisees. I don't know why they did this. I'm not really sure what their intention was in bringing him to the Pharisees, perhaps trying to be helpful. maybe trying to figure out what they should do about this, going to the respected sort of religious leaders of the common man, who the Pharisees represented in large part. But they brought him to the Pharisees maybe just to try to figure out what we need to do in a case such as this. And so the Pharisees already have their hackles up, because it happens that this took place on the Sabbath day. And his making of that clay in the ground would, under the stricter than the law of Moses traditions of the Pharisees, have involved work. Interestingly, back in verse 4, when Jesus is talking, he doesn't really shy away from talking about what he's doing. I must work the works of him who sent me. I've got to do this kind of work, whether or not it is on the Sabbath. But the Pharisees note this, and so they ask this blind man who had received his sight, how did this happen? And he said to them exactly what had happened, exactly what he'd already told his friends. He put clay on my eyes, I washed, and I see. So some of the Pharisees said, well, this man is not from God, speaking of Jesus. He can't certainly be someone who came from God, because he doesn't keep the Sabbath. Here he is just brazenly flouting our traditions and the law. He doesn't keep the Sabbath. Others said, bringing up a good point, well, how can a man who is a sinner do such things? So there's some division created there among them. Verse 17, they said to the blind man again, what do you say about him because he opened your eyes? What's your opinion? They ask him to weigh in. And so the man says, he is a prophet. Well, the Jews didn't believe this testimony. They didn't believe concerning him that he had been blind and received his sight, until they called the parents of him who had received his sight. Now they're doubting that this is all just part of an act. This is all just part of a setup that someone's put in place. This man wasn't previously blind. He's maybe just acting, or he's just pretending to be someone else. So they call his parents in and see if they'll go on record. So they ask the parents in verse 19, is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he now see? His parents answered them and said, we know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but by what means he now sees, we do not know. Or who opened his eyes, we do not know. He's of age, ask him. He'll speak for himself. Now, verse 22, John clarifies for us that his parents said these things sort of evasively, just removing themselves from the situation. I can only tell you two things about it. A, yes, it's our son. B, yes, he was born blind. Beyond that, I don't know. You just need to talk to him. And John informs us that they said this because they feared the Jews. For the Jews had agreed already that if anyone confessed that Jesus, that he was Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue. He'd be excommunicated. Wouldn't be allowed to come into that place anymore and do what a Jewish man in those times was required to do. So his parents therefore said, he's of age, ask him. We really don't want anything to do with this. So the Pharisees again called the man who was blind and said to him, give God the glory. And that's not necessarily implying there that they think this was something miraculous that happened. That was really just an idiom of the time that saying, tell the truth. Quit lying about this. We have maybe vestiges of that idea in a similar phrase we hear sometimes, speak the truth and shame the devil. Now, that's kind of the idea here. Give God the glory. Just fess up. Just tell the truth here. We know that this man is a sinner. And he answers again, whether he's a sinner or not, I do not know. One thing I know, that though I was blind, now I see. So they said to him again, what did he do to you? Tell us one more time. What's going on here? How did he open your eyes? And he answered them, I told you already and you didn't listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples? Or you're getting interested in learning more about Jesus? You want me to fill you in a little bit more? And they get really angry at that. In verse 28, they reviled him and said, you are his disciple, but we are Moses' disciples. We know that God spoke to Moses. As for this fellow, this Jesus, we do not know where he is from. The man answered and said to them, why, this is a marvelous thing, that you do not know where he is from, yet he has opened my eyes. Now we know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, he hears him. Since the world began, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who was born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. That's pretty good logic to me, isn't it, to you? This man opened my eyes. He has some kind of miraculous power. I know I didn't see yesterday, and I'm seeing today. How's he able to do that if he's a sinner? No sinner would be able to do that. You would have to come from God to be able to do that, to work that kind of miracle that no one in the world has been able to do before. So they answered in verse 34, "You were completely born in sins, and are you teaching us?" And they cast him out. There might be some reference there in their accusation, verse 34, "You were completely born in sins." They might be referring to sort of what the disciples had asked at the beginning of the chapter. Who was the sinner that resulted in this man being blind in the first place? And this man who was born blind, now the Pharisees are saying, "You were just born wholly and completely in sin, and now you think you're going to tell us what's going on? You just get out of here." So they cast him out. Not necessarily meaning here that they did excommunicate him, but rather sort of just that they removed him from the building, removed him from the premises. As I mentioned a moment ago, I would love to have sat down with this man. Wouldn't you love to talk to this blind man that Jesus healed, who is, even during questioning by the Pharisees, he's solid and forthright. He's growing slowly throughout this process towards more and more confidence in Jesus as something far greater than a kind person. His responses have this kind of sharp humor to them, but he's not irreverent. He's not flippant. He's not disrespectful. He shows much more courage than his parents. He lacks any fear of reprisal from the enemies of Jesus. But the most remarkable part of his story, and what we want to really focus in on this evening, begins in verse 35, after the man is cast out of the synagogue. Jesus, hearing that they had removed him from the building, goes in verse 35 and finds this man. Jesus went and found him. And he said to him, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" Or your version might say the Son of Man. Both are clearly meant to be titles that point out exactly who Jesus is, his position as the Messiah, his position as the Son of God, this divine being who was sent. And the man answered and said, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him? I'm just not sure because I don't really know who he is yet." And Jesus said to him, "You have both seen him." You realize what the Lord did there. That's kind of a clever turn of phrase to use for this particular man. "You have seen him." You didn't see anything at all before today, but now you have both seen the Son of God, and it is he who is talking with you. And then he said, "Lord, I believe." He did believe in the Son of God, the Son of Man, and he worshiped him. Jesus goes and finds the man, presumably somewhere in the streets of the city. This was the Lord and Savior, the ultimate teacher himself. We think sometimes of Jesus as the rabbi, the instructor, the teacher, the preacher, par excellence, the one who is better than any that have come before or since. And here he's going up on a follow-up visit. What a thought. What an amazing thing. Something about this man was so appealing to Jesus on some level that the Lord knew if he found this particular man again, he would have found a disciple indeed. It's a great credit to this man, a great testimony to him, and largely so because if you flip through the pages of the Gospels, do that sometime, maybe do that this evening, just take a cursory examination of the Gospel accounts, looking at the times when Jesus has encounters with other people, when he has interactions with men and women, and you will note repeatedly the refrain, the introductory part of those encounters, of those meetings, is something on the order of, "Then came to him blank," or "Then they brought to him person X." Then someone approached Jesus and said this. It is always, not quite always, almost always the case in the Scriptures that anytime Jesus meets with humanity, they came to him. It is the very rare occasion that you find Jesus himself going to find one individual, saying, "I'm looking for this person. I need to talk to you in particular." We do see this happening a couple of other times. Luke chapter 19 tells us about Zacchaeus, maybe a more well-known man than some of the folks Jesus talked to in the Scriptures, even got his own song eventually that we like to sing with our young people. Zacchaeus in Luke chapter 19, those first 10 verses portray his meeting with the Lord. And he places himself directly in the Lord's path. But isn't it still a wonder that Jesus picked this short man out of the throng to not only come down from that tree and meet him, but to have him as a guest at home? Zacchaeus would have been easy, regardless of whether or not he's up in that tree, would have been easy to overlook, and had been apparently overlooked many times in his life because of his stature. But Jesus found him. The account reads as though Jesus comes upon him and says, Well, finally, Zacchaeus, I'm glad you're here. Time that we went and met. I'm going to your house today. I'm going to be your guest at home. Zacchaeus comes down and receives him joyfully. Jesus found him. All of the apostles, to some degree, were called by Jesus. They were men that the Lord found. They were chosen men, found men. But some stand out in particular among them. For instance, if you turn to John chapter 1, John chapter 1, we read about Philip. Jesus was, in verse 43, about to begin a journey, about to begin traveling. He was, as John tells us earlier in the chapter, he was currently in Bethany beyond the Jordan, Bethabara, a town on the eastern side of the Jordan River, where John the Baptist had been baptizing his disciples. Jesus had passed through there on a few occasions and had met Simon Peter and had met Andrew, and apparently had met Philip already, is the way the account sounds, if we're surmising what is going on here, that this was not their first encounter, but for all we know, it might have been. Regardless, Jesus decides that he's about to go up to Galilee. He's going to go northwest and go back to his homelands in Galilee. But he decides to take a companion for his travels and simply instructs Philip, "You come with me. You follow me. We'll go back up to Galilee together. Follow me." There's no record of interaction between the two leading up to this. It's clear Philip had talked to him, though. He was likely a disciple of John's, had seen Jesus. So with little preamble, Jesus finds another follower, finds this man, has him follow him. Or we could look at the example of Matthew. Matthew tells us about his calling by Jesus in Matthew chapter 9, beginning in verse 9. Luke's account gives a few more details in Luke chapter 5, beginning in verse 27. Charmingly, there's, to me, some appeal in the difference between these two accounts. It is not Matthew who supplies the information that Matthew or Levi threw the feast in Jesus' honor after the Lord called him to be a tax gatherer, or after he had called him from being a tax gatherer to be his disciple, rather. It's Luke that tells us that Matthew threw the feast. It's also Luke who tells us that Matthew left all in order to follow the Lord. Matthew is very small on the details that would enlarge his presence in the story. He's trying to cut himself out as much as possible. But regardless, we see in that instance, there's Matthew sitting in the tax office one moment and then called on a life-altering, world-altering mission by the God of all things in the next moment. Can you imagine your life changing more from one moment to the next than that time when Jesus said to Matthew, "Follow me," and he did it? Going from being a publican to being an apostle of Jesus Christ. What did Matthew have? What was the appeal? What was the draw there that caught the eye of Jesus? Something was there, as the Lord saw it. He found a faithful apostle. These are astonishingly rare cases. I've mentioned these this morning. We could perhaps look in Luke chapter 5 earlier, Peter and Andrew and James and John, those fishermen who it seems were known to Jesus for quite a bit longer. We see Jesus calling them. Outside of those accounts, and I talk to me afterward if you can think of others. I've read through the Gospels. I talked to several people about this beforehand this week. Can you think of any other times where this happened, where Jesus went and found individual people and came to them instead of the common process of the gospel where people are always coming to him, those people that Jesus sought out? I can't think of any more. These are rare cases. And this makes them interesting, to me at least, but it also makes them important. There's something beautiful in its own right about those people who came to Christ, those who searched him out on their own. But would it not have been something of a great honor to have had the Lord find you instead. Where Jesus comes to you individually. Maybe 40 other people on the street at the time. But He looks at you and turns Himself in your direction and looks in your eyes and says, come with me. I've got something I need you to do. You follow me. Jesus approaching one whom He had healed earlier, going back to him, saying, now do you believe? What do you think now? Now I've found you a second time. Do you believe in the Son of God? What an honor to be treated in such a way by the Creator. And the question I want to consider this evening, can we be like these people? Can we be like the ones that Jesus found? We talk a lot in our society, and we'll talk in just a moment even, it is a valid construct, about people who are looking for Jesus. And we should be, and we need to be, and that'll be our first point. But can we not also, by our character, be the kind of people that Jesus was looking for? The kind of people that Jesus found when He was working on this earth. Can we be like this? I think so. A first trait that many of these men shared, they were looking for Him. We see this definitely from Zacchaeus, who put forth no little effort in Luke's gospel account in Luke 19, just to get a glimpse of Jesus as He passed by. There on a physical level, Zacchaeus wanted to see Jesus, to get a sense of Him, to hear Him, to have some sort of encounter, a real meaningful encounter with Jesus. Maybe he knew the Lord by reputation or by rumor. I mean, if you lived in Judea at this time, you've heard of Jesus of Nazareth. His name has reached you. You've heard of Him. Maybe you've heard some snippets of things that He had supposedly been teaching. But now here He is coming through your town. He's going to be here at this time. And you can maybe see the crowd from a long ways off that is following Him as He goes along. And you want to see for yourself. You want to hear Him yourself, be able to actually measure what He is saying and see what He is going to do. He wanted real interaction. Philip, too, comes across as one who was looking, because his words to Nathanael tell us. We didn't read further on in John chapter 1, but what's the first thing Philip does after the Lord tells him, follow me? Philip found Nathanael, his good friend apparently, and said to him, we have found Him, of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. What does that imply if he says, we found Him? You know what that means. It says we've been looking for Him. We've been waiting for Him. It reminds me of the man that Luke introduces us to earlier in his gospel, Simeon, the one who was looking for, was waiting for the consolation of Israel. He had lived his whole life in anticipation of the Messiah coming and being among His people. Philip strikes me very much in that same vein. We found Him. The one that Moses talked about, the one that the prophets talked about, the one that the whole book is about. We found Him. He's here among us. Do you want to come see Him? And Nathanael ultimately goes with him to discover for himself. Maybe Philip was not specifically searching for Jesus of Nazareth, but he was absolutely looking for the Messiah. And so he and his good friend had put forth diligent effort in learning the Scriptures so that they'd know the man when he came. Jesus elsewhere in Matthew chapter 7, maybe we can appropriate some of his words here for our point and those who are looking for Jesus. Matthew chapter 7 and verse 7, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and it will be opened to you. He goes on to talk about the fact your Father, Even you earthbound people, you know how to give good things to your children. If he asks for an egg, you're not going to give him a scorpion. You're not going to just play some cruel trick on your child who asks for something. How much more, verse 11, will your Father who is in heaven give good things to those who ask Him? Hebrews 11 and verse 6 tells us about the Lord being a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. We have to have faith in that idea and that character attribute of our God. How often have we seen in our lives? I'm sure you have known these people. I would be surprised if I weren't talking to some tonight who have been this person. The honest seeker of Jesus Christ, who has put into his or her path the right person at the right moment who leads you to Christ. You've been looking for a long time. Maybe you've tried various churches. Maybe you've tried various faiths. Maybe you've tried for a long time with no faith whatsoever and haven't really paid attention to the Scriptures. And then in that moment of time, you meet someone who might just say, come worship with me tonight. Or they might say, do you want to read the Bible with me together? Let's start reading one of the Gospels. We'll talk about what we find in there. Let's just study a few of those things. And that person, through just that one moment or those few moments, ends up becoming a disciple, becomes a Christian, becomes a follower of Jesus Christ. Don't we all know people like this that God has put in their path, has put in their way, what they need to bring that person to Him? I was talking to my mom just this afternoon, one of the sisters there in Arlington, where my folks live. I suppose it's been 20 years. She's a few years older than me, but not many. Maybe 20 years ago. Was a worldly person, had no religious care at all. Began dating a member of the church there in Arlington. They were both working at the same restaurant. We're both just servers at the same restaurant. This young man that she was dating did not really have much spiritual interest himself. Ended up not being very faithful for the remainder of his life. But because of this relationship that they had, this young woman came to the church there, met some folks, began worshiping with us regularly. After those two had broken up, continued worshiping faithfully, continued studying, became a Christian, converted and married a husband, a different man than she had been dating before, has now raised two children who are sweet young people that are showing the signs you would hope to see of those who will become Christians themselves. How does that happen in a person's life? Why would that be the case? Here's a person who has honesty of heart, who is seeking the Lord, who wants to know something that is right to do in their lives, and just those collisions in life. You meet the right person, the chance encounter. You pick the flyer up off of the bulletin board. You have that thing that is placed in your way that you need to find Jesus. Those who look for Christ, who don't want to just hear about Him, but want to hear Him, who want to look into and have looked into and have read and have studied so they know what they should be searching for, those people find Him. Those are the people that Jesus found Himself when He was on the earth. People that were looking. People that had their eyes open. We need to be those kinds of people who are, even after we believe we have found Him, we continue searching for Him. And we need to help those who are looking as well. We don't always know what that person's going to look like. They may be the person who is worldly, who is not living as they should, who is in a bad state of life, who is not in any way like us. They don't look like us. They don't act like us. They don't talk like us. They might be looking for Christ. What a shame it would be if we couldn't show them to Him. Those are the people Jesus found, those who were looking. A second trait we can see with many of these folks, they're honest with themselves. This goes along with the person who is truly looking. We alluded to this a moment ago. But what I mean here is that Jesus found people who could clearly assess the evidence that was being presented. They could logically look at that and make an honest and unbiased decision about what to do with the Lord. Our blind man in John chapter 9 is to me a perfect example of this. He begins slow. He simply, you notice in John chapter 9 when he's asked about Jesus, his opinion of who he was changes just a little bit when he's first asked. He says it's just this man called Jesus. Just some man who is called Jesus. I don't really know anything else about him. And later on, under scrutiny, under the questioning of the Pharisees, he has to believe, well, Jesus is a prophet. I think that's what he is. He's a prophet. He's someone who is doing something that he's been enabled to do by God. And then just slowly working his way logically through with the unwitting help of the Pharisees, who seem to be kind of helping him along in his search by their questions and by their umbrage, he concludes that Jesus did in fact come from God, because how else could you explain it? We mentioned in reading this account the first time, this guy's using sound logic. He's reasoning his way through. He's looking at the evidence. He's not filtering it through his own bias or what he'd like to be true or what he's heard to be the case before, or what would be the very easy thing for him to do, which in this case obviously would be just to kind of go along with the Pharisees, go along with the religious ruling class and be happy with what they want him to say. Well, only men with divine authority can heal blind people. I can see today, and I've never seen anything else in my life before this time. So clearly, Jesus is no sinner. He is sent from God. Logic and rationality mix with his personal experience to show him the way. He ends up believing on Jesus as the Son of God by the end of the account. How do you reach that point? Wishing his way there? No, he's thinking about it. He's being honest. He's really assessing the evidence. What about Philip once more? In John chapter 1, Philip, he's been reading Moses and the prophets. He knows that the Messiah is coming and apparently had a good idea what he'd look like when he got there. So Philip is able to really sort of like, you remember those Highlights magazines? They put these maybe in a lot of dentist's offices and pediatrician's offices and things. Those Highlights magazines would have two pictures, and it says, you know, find 10 differences between the two of them. And the cat's wearing a baseball hat in this one, and he's not in this one. And the kids are playing with the football in this one and a basketball in this one. You've got two pictures that look pretty much the same, but have a few differences in them. Really, what Philip is doing when he has this conversation he apparently has with Jesus, the Lord is presenting some evidence to him. And Philip is then able to hold up the Law and the Prophets. He's able to hold up what Moses has written and just put that right up next to what Jesus is saying to him and say, find the differences. Find what doesn't match. And he comes up empty. He doesn't find any bone of contention. He doesn't see anything that the Lord is telling him that would not prove definitively that he was not the Christ. He has no choice based on his examination of that evidence to determine, we found him. Nathaniel, this is the guy. He is legit. This is the one that we have been looking for. We have found him that has been written of, and you need to come and look at him too. He let his decision be based upon that. These were thinking men. These were people who were not biased by their past, by their preconceptions, by what other people wanted them to do. They were simply going to look at the evidence, and we're going to look at the truth, and we're going to say, is this accurate? Does this make sense? Is this truthful? Does this hold up to scrutiny? Jesus wants people to follow him, to be his disciples, his brethren, his fellow heirs who are refashioned in his glorious image. But he is not going to drag people kicking and screaming out of the world to be believers. He's given us evidence. He has given us proof. He's given us sound things to rely upon and has presented in the Gospels, in the entirety of the Bible, this surpassingly logical and sound record for us to follow. I investigate the Gospel accounts and I believe in Jesus because no other conclusion makes sense to me. I can't find anything else when I compare what I know of the world, what I can observe about the world, what I can read of in these books, and what is verified by so many other sources. Looking at all of the evidence that I have around me, the only conclusion I can come to that makes sense from all angles is that the man portrayed in these four books of the Bible was the Son of God, that Jesus is the Christ, and that everything that we're told he did those things. I don't see another avenue that makes sense, and so I believe. That is precisely, it seems to me, what Jesus went looking for. People who are going to be able to do that. To be able to examine and look and think critically and think rationally and say, you know what? This man's telling the truth. This man's coming to us from God. That's what Jesus found in so many of these men. A final point this evening, however, these folks are not ashamed of him. Jesus is looking for people who are not going to be embarrassed to be his disciples. We see Matthew immediately holding that great feast in the Lord's honor. And sure enough, he and his friends and his co-workers are met with reviling and ridicule for their perceived sinfulness. But Matthew doesn't care. Matthew doesn't have any time to worry about that. He wanted to bring other people to Jesus. He has in mind some other folks, some other of those tax collectors maybe, who need to meet this same man that he's met and maybe need to have their lives changed in the same way that Matthew's was going to be changed, who might learn to follow him the way Matthew is going to. Philip follows the same way. He's going to go with Christ. He's going to journey with Christ to Galilee. But he knows it's much better to bring another friend on that journey as well. So he says, Nathanael, you come too. You need to see this. Even after Nathanael was initially resistant, can anything good come out of Nazareth? I mean, you must have gotten the wrong place from this guy if you're saying he's the Messiah. He didn't come from any Nazareth. And Philip says, you just see for yourself. You come along and look. Instead of being embarrassed, instead of saying, yeah, you're right, that is kind of a silly idea. He's probably not who he says he is. We'll do something else today. No, he says, you need to come and look at this for yourself. Zacchaeus received the Lord into his house after what could have been an embarrassing episode, or at least one that might have caused some amused chuckles from the crowd as he kind of scampers down from that sycamore tree. Once again, though, he doesn't care about people accusing him of evil, which happens in Luke chapter 19. They reviled a whole bunch. I mean, here's Jesus again going to go eat with sinful men. Zacchaeus isn't fazed by that. He doesn't care if he was unceremonious in climbing down that tree. He just joyfully receives Jesus, it says, as he had him into his home. The blind man is thrown out of the synagogue because he told the truth about the Lord and didn't back down from that under continued and more heated scrutiny. He says, no, this is what he did. This is what happened. This is who he must be. And I don't care what you have to say about it, because this is what I know to be true. He wasn't about to be intimidated into saying something false. Are we ashamed of Jesus? Or do we wear his name proudly? Do we worship him and follow him when he's called? That's what the man in John chapter 9 does after he says, Lord, I believe. He worshiped him. He's going to be one who follows the Lord, who worships him, who gives him honor and reverence. Do we do that when we're called, even if we, like Matthew, have to forsake everything to be his disciples? Jesus found people who were willing to pay the price, who were willing to follow him, who were willing to leave behind whatever they needed to, who were willing to be ridiculed. They followed him with no shame, with no regret. That's what Jesus found when he looked for these people. Ultimately, Luke chapter 19, in verse 10, at the very end of that account of Zacchaeus, Jesus speaks in a way that reminds us, ultimately, Jesus came to find us all. The Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost. We talked about individuals that Jesus found, individual people that he went looking for and made a beeline for. But the reality of the situation is, if you are a lost person, if you have been a lost person, you are exactly who Jesus came to find. You are exactly the person that he was looking for while he was on the earth. That sick person who is in need of the physician, and that is who he continues to look for, who he continues to desire to draw to himself, the people that he continues to want to save, the ones he paid for with his life, with his blood to save, to seek and to save that which was lost. This evening, if you are one who would be considered lost, Jesus wants to find you. He came looking. I hope that you've been looking for him. I hope that you have been diligent in your pursuit of him. Have you read these books? Have you looked at this collection of books written in his name, written about him, that proclaim his goodness, that proclaim his work? Have you looked at those? Have you talked with someone about these? We would be happy to sit down with you at any time and talk to you about what you find in here. Why we can believe it. Why I think that you could work your way logically and sensibly to the conclusion that Jesus is exactly who he claimed to be and who these men claimed him to be, and why so many people have followed him. Do you need help with that? Are you seeking the Lord? We hope you are. And we hope that nothing would make us happier tonight than for one to come forward this evening and say, I've been looking for Christ. I believe I've found him. I just need to obey him. I need to do what he's told me to do so that I can enter into an eternal relationship with him. Obey the Lord. Become his disciple. Follow him just as all those people that he sought out and called to himself. Follow me. You do that. You listen to him. You obey him. You repent as he has told you to repent of sins that have placed you in an adversarial position against God and that have, by the way, only harmed yourself. Turn away from those things. You confess your faith. A proud, something that you can do with a modicum of pride to acknowledge that Jesus is the Son of God. That's not something to be ashamed of. That's something to be proclaimed from the highest point in town. Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. You be baptized into Christ. Take part in His death. Have fellowship with the death and the burial and the days in the tomb and the raising that showed His power and His glory above all else. Obey the Lord this evening. Follow Him if you have found Him. Come forward if you have need while we stand and sing this song.